SQL Server for Developers with Sam Nasser.
The Azure DevOps Podcast is a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Each show brings you hard-hitting interviews with industry experts, innovating better methods, and sharing success stories. Listen on to learn how to increase quality, ship quickly, and operate well. And now your host, Jeffrey Palermo.
Welcome to the show. I'm Jeffrey Palermo, your host. Make sure to check out www.azuredevops.show for the past episodes and show notes, and we've had some great shows. And the goal of this podcast has always been to empower you and your development teams with the information that you need to move fast, deliver consistent quality using the .NET ecosystem, and run your software systems with confidence in Azure. And for those of you running .NET and Azure-related user groups, I've been doing a lot of online video presentations. And if you run one of those user groups, I'd love to give a presentation for your group. Also, our sponsor and my employer, ClearMeasure, is a software architecture company that empowers .NET teams to be self-sufficient and able to deliver world-class results. And if we can help, please get in touch. And if you are a .NET developer and would like a path to become an architect, we are hiring. Just apply on the website, clearmeasure.com, and there's several positions open at the time of this recording. Now let's get on to our show. I'm really excited for our guest today, Sam Nasser. He is an IT consultant specializing in .NET and SQL Server and Azure. He's a senior software engineer that has a deep focus on the Microsoft stack of technologies more broadly. And as a part of NIS Technologies, he provides consulting services, training, and custom app development to help bring more value to business applications. And he's also a leader at the Cleveland C-Sharp VB.NET User Group. Sam, welcome to the show. How are you, sir?
Very good, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We had a great time at your user group last month. And I appreciate you having me. That was a lot of fun.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah, you're a big leader in the community in your region. You also do a lot of speaking. But for those maybe who haven't heard you speak or not familiar with you, can you give us a little bit of background and what some highlights of your career has been?
Sure. So I've been a software developer since 1995, been focusing mostly on the Microsoft platform since about 2000, so 20 years now, which, my God, seems like an eternity.
Just getting started.
We're just getting started, right. I've been focusing and trying to make myself as best of a developer as I can be. So I've started also getting involved in user groups, conferences, writing articles, expanding my horizons on always trying to keep on top of newer technologies. And I found that conferences was the best way of doing that. So I'm a big advocate of user groups and community leadership. And I've also learned that the more you put into it, the more you get out of it. And the more you help others, the more you're actually helping yourself as well. Mm-hmm. So it's been a very fruitful endeavor, and it's something that I'm continuing to pursue regularly.
Yeah. And you do a lot of speaking, teaching, sharing your knowledge. One I heard one time, it stuck with me. Somebody said, experts teach. And it's not because, hey, experts must teach. It's because if you've developed some expertise and you keep it to yourself and share it with no one, then no one has any idea what you know. No one can benefit from what you've learned. But if you share, then other people look and say, ah, look at this expert.
Well, not only that, I agree with you, but in addition, you also learn by teaching. And what I mean mm-hmm. by that is I've actually taught structured courses in development boot camps. And I've taught a few courses that lasted only a few days, as well as conference speaking. And every time you're presenting something, you're addressed with a question that you may not know the answer to. And so you have to go back and research it, or someone will ask you, what is the meaning of this? And you have to rephrase it in a way that they would understand the meaning of it. So, for example, I was teaching development bootcamp, and they were asking me about data types. What is a data type? Why do we have to know about it? And I said, think of it this way. if I gave you an address, 123 Main Street, and you went there, you're going to see some kind of a real estate type structure, right? It could be a business retail, it could be a residential address, could be a parking garage, could be a variety of things. Mm-hmm. Every building structure allows you to do different things. So, for example, I can't go and take up residence in a parking lot, right? Legally at least, right?
Right, most places.
I can't go and open up a store inside of my apartment. So by setting different data types, it allows me to do different things to that data. For example, I can't add a string together. I can concatenate them, but I can't add or subtract strings. I can add and subtract numbers, but I can't concatenate them. I can only do that to strings. So that helped to get the point across, and it helped me to dig a little bit deeper to get a better understanding of it. And that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah. And for those out listening who may think, oh, I need to gain more experience, I don't have anything to teach, I would say everybody has something to teach because everybody has learned something deeply.
Absolutely. Everyone has something to share. And unfortunately, a lot of people just have this thought in the back of their minds that if I get up, I'm going to be demolished by the audience. They're going to ask me questions and embarrass me that I don't know. And if you don't know, just politely say, I don't know, but I will get back to you, get their contact information and follow up with them. That is key. It's not a matter of just getting through one question and that's it, but you know, follow up on it.
Right, right. And not just speaking, I lament Twitter and Facebook and all the micro, what used to be called microblogging, kind of put a damper on the popularity of just more long form blogs. And there was a season, probably a 10-year run where long form blogging, people writing just short articles, was pretty popular, and there was tons of information shared. There's not as much information shared with little Twitter blips.
And unfortunately, even like with the tweets now, like a lot of the technical folks that I follow, mm-hmm. they kind of strayed away from the technical content and gotten more into politics and foodie related things.
Yeah. Funny memes.
Like, yeah, I'm following you for the technical content. Give me that.
Right, right, right. Well, speaking of technical content, I mean, you've got some interesting things on your GitHub account, but you are also have done some presentations multiple times around SQL Server, but you told me before the show you focus on SQL Server for developers as opposed to the DBA. What is your mindset on that, and can you frame that for us?
So back in 2008, with the introduction of SQL Server 2008, they introduced some development features that I thought were very interesting. One of them was called file streams. And this was a feature that helped developers answer the age-old question of, I have a large binary file. I can do one of two things with it. I can put it in a shared drive and then just put the pointer to that or the location of it in my database. So that way I don't bloat my database, but I have no control over what happens to that file, who reads it. I simply hope that no one deletes it by accident, right? Mm-hmm. And then the other side of the token is I can store that entire binary file in my database and have full control over it. But now I have bloated my database. So, you know, where is the fine line? And so they answered that by using file streams. And what that allows you to do is essentially store the binary files in the same file group that's managed by SQL Server. So it stores it on the disk, but there's a pointer to it in the database. And it manages that pointer, and it also manages where the files are located. And so it gives you the best of both worlds right out of the box, very little configuration. And then going further into 2012, they came up with something called file tables. And that builds on file streams. And now I can create a table that essentially mimics what that folder looks like. I have all the metadata regarding those files. I can access the content of those files, and I can do that not only programmatically, but I can also do it through T-SQL as well. So anyone sitting at SQL Server Management Studio can query and see the contents of that folder. And then if I'm running a web app, then I can also stream the contents of those files in that folder. And another beautiful feature that builds on top of that.
Well, before I want to get some clarification on that. You said file tables and you said folder. Does that mean it is still accessible with Windows Explorer?
Yes.
Is it truly a folder?
Well, not truly a folder. It appears to be a shared folder on the network, but it is managed by SQL Server.
Gotcha.
So the reason I say it seems to be is because if I was to take that file table offline, then that folder disappears. It's no longer visible.
Okay, but it's accessible programmatically with a file path.
It can be, yes. Assuming that the file table is still up and running, then it's manageable and it's accessible.
Okay. All right, and so you're building on that.
Right. So building on that, using the text search feature that's available in SQL Server, now I have the files that are contained within SQL Server. They're managed by it. They're accessed by SQL Server. So it can actually read the entire contents of that file, and I can search for certain keywords. So, for example, the example that I presented at the various conferences was, let's say that I have a car lot, for example. I'm a huge car buff, by the way. And so if I have a car lot where I constantly have an inventory of cars coming in, and I have a customer who's searching for something that is a V6 with leather. So I can quickly search and see which cars have V6 and leather. Mm-hmm. And I do that by simply having a spec sheet for every vehicle. And then you essentially, when the cars come into the lot, you click and drag all those files, put them in that folder, and immediately at the snap of a finger, SQL Server will then import those files into the file table. It will perform the text searching using the catalog, and then I can query on it, and immediately I know which vehicle has a V6 and leather right off the bat.
Mm-hmm.
So
nice.
Built-in features that kind of build on top of each other using file streams and text search into file tables that just make life so much easier. And it again answers that age-old question, what do I do with a binary file, right?
Yeah.
So now not only do I have a great place and a great way of storing it, but I have a great way of accessing it too.
Mm. Now, is there a lower threshold where you say, don't mess with this, just put it right there as a column in the table directly?
So as far as like text searching, you can do that.
Or a small PDF file. Sometimes, you know, the header information is in the table, but then the contents of a PDF quote attachment is just stored. Is that now tend to be a bad idea universally, or are there situations where no, just stick it right there in the table. Don't use these extended features.
So essentially you wouldn't be sticking the file into the table. What you're doing is you're copying that file into a folder or what appears to be a folder. And that's managed by SQL Server. So once you do that, then immediately all the contents are accessible by SQL Server.
Okay. I guess my question is to store the bits in a binary column in the table. Like before those features came out.
Yeah. So now that we have that feature available, it's very easy to set up. So I would say I would fight against having it in a separate column. Even though like a lot of clients, they always say, well, it's just a one-time use. That one-time use is only going to be for today, but by next week, you're going to need to use that and expand on that. So when I'm dealing with a client, you always need to kind of look to the future and kind of help understand what it is that they're going to want in the future as opposed to what they just need today.
I always like to go for those, not just the 80-20 rules, but the 99% rule where I say, okay, go with this first, always go with this. And the caveat to always is if it doesn't seem to be working, you may have a special case, then look at alternatives. But unless you have that special case where it won't work, just do it that way.
Right. Yeah. I agree with you.
Cool. Well, that's awesome. Now, a lot of developers, their world into SQL Server is okay, I have a schema, stick it in SQL Azure, and I'm going to use Entity Framework and I'm going to access it. Do all these features have a corollary with all of their experience through Entity Framework, or are there some where you have to go directly to T-SQL to make use of them?
Yeah, unfortunately, you have to go directly through T-SQL to do that. But keep in mind, with Entity Framework, you can submit a raw SQL statement and have it process and then bring the result set back. So, can you do file tables through Entity Framework? technically no, not as a native feature of EF, but there are ways around it.
Okay, where you could still do a normal query, and right. and those work.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Now, those are file tables. You also done some work with temporal tables. Can you tell us what those are?
Yeah, so that's another cool feature. So let's say in the case where I accidentally delete a few records from a table, first of all, it's going to be followed by some expletives, and then I have mm-hmm. to go to the DBA on my hands and knees and apologize. I would ask for a restore of a previous database, something recent. They put that into a temporary place. I copy the records that I need, put them into production. So it's kind of a lengthy process, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or you take into consideration an issue where a customer is changing their email on a regular basis for whatever reason. And they keep complaining that they're not getting the email for the order they submitted. So for those two scenarios, temporal tables, what it offers is basically a constant dynamic backup of your data that's accessible through T-SQL. And so in one of the demos that I have is a user changed her email multiple times and she complained that she didn't get the order information. So you can query for the email address to see what was it between timeframe A and timeframe B, specify the timeframe. And what it will do is it will actually query the current table as well as the historical table. It will union the results dynamically and then return them. So I can see what her current email address is as it is now, and then how many times it changed over the past 3 months, and all that will be returned in the query set.
Many thanks to our podcast sponsor, Clear Measure. Clear Measure is a software architecture company that empowers clients' development teams to be self-sufficient, moving fast, delivering quality, and running their systems with confidence. Whether starting a new project or developing new technologies or techniques, Clear Measure sets up your team to deliver world-class results. Learn more at www.clearmeasure.com. Clear Measure, empowering software delivery.
Now, immediately what came to my mind was one reason why so many fact tables and analytical databases get started is just to have records that have a time dimension. So with these temporal tables, does it actually alleviate the need just to make a fact table for that purpose, or is it not quite suited for time-based analytical queries?
So it is suitable for time-based analytics, and you have a basically every temporal table has two columns, the start time and the end time. And those have to be included and they're automatically generated, and it uses a date time two data type. So the time slot is very specific down to the seventh decimal place of a second. And so you can essentially query for that specific time frame. And then every record essentially shows the start time of when that record became valid, and then the end time of when that record was either deleted or overwritten.
Mm-hmm.
And so that time slot is when the record was alive, quote unquote. And so in the case of a user that changes it multiple times, you're going to have multiple start and stops for those records. And it stores the entire record, not just the fields that have changed. And so that way you can query everything. Just do a simple select star from, and then there's an additional clause to specify either in between or from a start time to an end time, and then it brings back the result set.
That's awesome. Seems like automatic change auditing.
Yeah, it's automatic magic is what it is. Straight out of the box, very little configuration. You set the whole thing up through T-SQL and Management Studio. You can use it either when you're creating the table at the initial creation, or you can add it on to an existing table. It's a great feature.
So if you've got create table, such and such, columns, what is that addition to get the temporal features added on?
So there's a couple things, and I speak to them, and I have the presentation on my YouTube. But essentially, first of all, you would need to specify the time period columns. And then there are some clauses that specify that it is always generated. And then you have to turn the temporal tables on. And again, all that is done through T-SQL. And if it's for an existing table, then you would just simply alter the table and add on those two columns with the clauses that the time is always generated. And then likewise, you can configure it so that to turn the historical tables on as well.
Nice. So no SQL, no server configuration. It's just in the schema and just a modification of the create table clause or create table command.
Yeah.
Very nice. That sounds really simple.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to go and turn this on. Awesome. Now, you did a lot of presentations. What conferences are of interest to you? You mentioned SQL Saturday.
Yeah. So the thing I love about SQL Saturday, especially in this COVID era, is that they're all virtual and they happen on Saturdays where most of us are not working. And so you can jump online, attend a SQL Saturday in some part of the world. Last Saturday, I attended one in Minnesota. This coming Saturday, I'll be attending one in Nigeria, and I'm based in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. So the world is only a click away, really. And the nice thing about them is they have various tracks that cover a variety of things regarding SQL Server. So you have business intelligence, performance tuning, DBA tasks, as well as development features about the things that I spoke about, temporal tables, file tables, that sort of thing. Nice. So it's a great all-day free training. When back in the good old days when we used to meet in person, it was also a great networking opportunity. And I'm also a big fan of networking because I heard one of the Microsoft evangelists once state, he said, the most important person in the room is not the one standing in the front, but the one sitting next to you. Mm-hmm. And so rubbing elbows with other developers is a great way to expand your horizons and learn things about the dev community and development at large.
Yeah, totally. Well, this is a DevOps podcast, and so we're always trying to figure out how to move fast and increase quality. And things can go wrong with the database, and the database and everything in it can sometimes break and do the wrong thing. So what is the current state of the art or practices that you're employing for building what is a database and testing everything that's in the database and then deploying what changes is in that database? What are you doing now? What practices are attainable and everybody should be using? And then what things are not quite there, but you're looking ahead to them?
So I'm a big fan of Entity Framework Code First. I think it's a great way of giving developers control of the database and its creation. Not to mention, as you're doing migrations, it also develops the plan of the migration as you're moving forward or if you have to revert back to a previous version. And then all these plans are in C# and they're stored in source control and the developers can see exactly where I'm at. The other nice thing is with EF, as soon as you turn on the application, if the database is not up to the level that it's expecting it, meaning it is not at the right migration level, you'll get an error message and notifying you that the database needs to be upgraded, as opposed to the old days where you just wait until an error occurred, right? So granted, EF has been around for a while, but it's still my favorite tool for database creation. I know a lot of people kind of cringe at accessing data through EF, but certainly for database creation and migrations, I still think it's one of the best tools out there.
Okay. What does it mean in 2020 to, quote, build a database? You know, we think about building C# and running some test suites and all that. So what does that mean today for a SQL Server database?
So, you know, it's really writing a script, essentially, is what building a database is, right? It includes the table structure. The key thing is you need a good understanding of what is a proper database. So unfortunately, I've come across projects where there are no primary index fields. There are no data types. Everything is a varchar all throughout.
Varchar max.
Right. Sorry, flexibility that way.
We're joking. Can you talk about Invarcar Max and why you wouldn't just make everything in Invarcar Max?
Oh, good God. Because you don't want to bloat the database with nothing, basically. You want to contain that data, allow limits on the columns. You want it to so that it can be easily indexed and queried. Invarcar Max, use it with sparingly, to say the least. But more importantly, in addition, all the basic fundamental concepts still apply. Foreign keys and data types and primary keys and indexes. You need to keep all that in mind as you're building a database. And if you don't, I strongly urge you to go and learn it. There's many great resources out there, but it's always good to take the time to build it right. One of the examples I always gave my class is I said, you're only building the foundation once and once only for a building, right? I can't get up to the 10th floor and realize, oh, my foundation is a little corrupt. Let me go back and change that. Mm-hmm. That's not going to be easy to do. Take the time, do the foundation as best as you can, and which is essentially the database in our world, because everything works off of the database, and then move forward. But don't be, apprehensive to spend the time on it. It's well worth the investment of time.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said everything uses the database. There's a lot of talk and a lot of choices with MongoDB and CosmosDB and just blob container storage and all these other things. But give us your opinion from a percentage-wise. Is it that, hey, the times when you would use SQL Server for are shrinking in percentage or are holding stable at a certain amount and you just kind of add these things around the edges where necessary? What's your view to someone that says, there's all these choices and there was this NoSQL movement and what should I be thinking?
Right. Okay. So there's always the right tool for the job. And I actually had a meeting with a client one time. And long story short, basically the big boss gave his ear to one of the younger guys that was on the team, a recent graduate. And a millennial, and he wanted to use the latest and greatest and all the sassy terminology. And basically, they wanted to get away from SQL Server and get onto Mongo. And not that I have anything wrong with Mongo, but I asked a simple question. I said, is your data relational? Yes. So why are you moving to a non-relational database? Well, it's less expensive, and there are ways of manipulating it so that it can seem to be relational. I didn't say it out loud, but in the back of my head, I said, I can also build a car out of duct tape. Doesn't mean I would want to drive it, right? Mm-hmm. So you use the right tool for the job. If I'm using relational data, I need a relational database. Non-relational, I can use Mongo or Cosmos or any of the other non-relational databases that are out there. And then you have to answer the questions of, of course, cost and licensing, availability. And then another key factor, it's not just what I perceive to be the best tool, but also what about my coworkers and the rest of the team at my client site? Can they manage this after I leave? Mm-hmm. And then furthermore, looking down the pipeline, how many people are actually experienced in a specific database versus others? Not to pick on Mongo or SQL Server, but hypothetically, let's say I have all the recent graduates are trained in Oracle. I also have to look down the road to see the newer employees that are going to be coming in, what's their experience going to be? Mm-hmm. So I can't build on something that is not going to have a future where not others are going to, or others will not be trained on it. I have to keep an eye out for that.
Yeah, that's a good point. There's so many corollaries with being a software architect as being a civil architect, and the availability of the trades are critical. You can pick a certain material or a particular style, but if there's only a small number of people around the world who have experience using those materials or style, then it's going to be hard to get that building built. You made this design decision, but because you just say it is so, it doesn't automatically make it work and fall into place nicely.
Hit the nail on the head. Exactly.
So, and that's been my experience too, is that SQL Server used to be a relational database, but now it just merely has a relational database, but it also has blob and binary storage in it. And it also has document storage capabilities in it. So now it's almost like it's a storage component, and whatever type of data you have, okay, pick it. But it's, SQL Server has an answer, seems like. And then you have your 5% specialized scenarios where, okay, we need to grab something just for that piece. But it seems like it's few and far between that I encounter a code base at any of our clients where they literally don't have SQL Server involved, at least.
It's a great product. Even though my day-to-day tasks are in Visual Studio working in C#, I absolutely love SQL Server. Despite all the many things that you had mentioned, we also forgot to give props to reporting services and integration services and analysis services. So all the other products that are basically revolving around it, or you could argue that they are part of it, essentially, right? I love it because of the ease of use, and you can do a lot with very little. To mention a tremendous amount of training resources and a great community around it.
Right. We've had a large number of clients who have significant database schemas for .NET applications, but the local development environment has moved not just, maybe a decade ago, it would have been SQL Server Developer Edition and have that going always. And then it was SQL Server Express. But now it's just SQL Local DB. And it's even that version handles pretty significant schemas very, very well.
Yeah, yeah. You can do a lot with it. And again, just the ease of use, honestly, just makes life so much easier in comparison with other database products that I've worked with. So I love it and continue to work with it.
Awesome. Well, Sam, thanks so much for being on the show. There's a lot of great information. We'll include some of the things we talked about in the show notes. For people who are kind of learning some things for the first time, are there any go-to resources that you would point them to keep going further?
Honestly, just Google it and you'd be amazed of the resources that will come back. There's a tremendous amount of information out there. Also, I strongly urge you, go sign up for SQLSaturday.com and you'll get notified of the various events and you can see all the different events that are happening worldwide. Thankfully, COVID did not slow it down. It actually helped it because now everything's gone virtual. Mm-hmm. And then in addition, if you miss a presentation or a specific day of the conference, you can go to their website and they have all the information uploaded there from the speakers, the PowerPoint slides, the demos, contact information. So you can always follow up with the presenters if you have any questions there. And also, I'm a big advocate of posting technical events on my blog, as well as the user group community. So SQLSaturday.com and meetup.com, two great resources for those who are just getting started, as well as for the seasoned experts who like to continue to expand their skill set.
Nice, nice. Awesome. Well, Sam, thanks again for being on the show. This is a great interview.
Thank you for having me, Jeff. It's been a pleasure.
And until next time. Keep shipping.
You've been listening to the Azure DevOps Podcast, a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Go to www.azuredevops.show for show notes and other episodes. On behalf of your host, Jeffrey Palermo, and our sponsors, thanks for listening, and may God bless you.